MyMag.com mini podcast number 14, sponsored by Small Dog Electronics and Innotech.com.
Hello, this is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration number 14. Please excuse any pops, bangs, or whizzes you hear going on behind me as I record this podcast. It's something known as Bonfire Night here in England today, and there's quite a lot of fireworks going off outside. I received some email from a listener this week discussing some problems they'd had setting up a wireless router for Windows. This got me thinking that perhaps one of the topics I should discuss within Fenestration is the issues of setting up equipment that's been designed for or is intended to be used with Windows computers. In many cases, these pieces of equipment can also be used with a Mac, and therefore dealing with the Windows installation process is something that ourselves as Mac users might have to contend with. Now, as I've discussed before, I was a Windows user for many years, and I've also worked in IT support. So I've got a pretty good idea what the Windows mindset is in terms of how Microsoft and the suppliers of Windows supporting products approach support of software and hardware installation on the Windows operating system. This difference in mindset can be quite unexpected if you're born and bred on the Mac platform. Now, on the Mac, things tend to be in one place. They're organised in such a way that a user, whatever their level of ability, can find them and make the appropriate changes to get something working or to get something done. Look at application installation as an example. To install an application, you simply drag it to your Applications folder in the main, or you run a small installer. Dragging that application to the Applications folder will install the application by copying all the appropriate dependencies to the right place on the computer. Most of them are in the Applications folder, or occasionally there's preferences files and that sort of thing in the Library folder, but the application installation takes care of that for you. Contrast this with the Windows installation. These pretty much always use an installer, but the installer will be different for different applications. It'll have a different number of screens, a different number of buttons that need to be pressed. You have to approve exactly where the application gets installed to. And the process itself will actually install bits and pieces of the application all over the computer. Another problem with Windows is that it's fairly complex underneath the surface. And Microsoft's default approach to dealing with this complexity is to provide you with a simple step-by-step wizard to actually deal with whatever needs to be configured or adjusted. They don't actually do anything about the complexity underneath, which means that you end up with a situation where there are two, three, on some cases, four ways of doing the same thing on a Windows installation. Applications from other vendors that support Windows can sometimes be even worse. If you buy a USB printer, for instance, you'll probably get a CD driver from the manufacturer that has a whole load of software that needs to be installed, supposedly, in order to get the printer to work. Four or five different applications is typically the norm, plus a configuration wizard that makes you do step-by-step, plug the cable in here, load the CD up here, press this button here. You get the picture, I'm sure. The difficulty with this approach is if something goes wrong, you're not actually sure whether you actually got the basic piece of hardware working or not, or whether it was a problem with one of the extra applications. And again, these methods that the computer manufacturers use to actually install their hardware will often conflict with the Windows default way of doing things. So that means you've got yet another place where you have to go and configure things in order to get your application or your piece of hardware working properly. This was the experience encountered by the listener concerned. They tried to get a cable modem and wireless router working, and because of the complexity of the installation, what would have taken 5-10 minutes on a Mac took them over 4 hours on a PC and involved them doing things at different locations to try and pin down problems, try and identify whether cables were faulty, this, that and the other. Now on Fenestrations in the future, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this because it's appropriate to users who are running Windows on their Intel Macs or on your virtual PC. So what I'm going to do is talk about the way Windows does certain things and some basic troubleshooting steps you can follow in order to troubleshoot things like printers, Windows file sharing, networking, that sort of thing. In the meantime, if you are in a situation where, as a computer-savvy user, you are asked to do an installation on something Windows-related, what I suggest you do is take one of two approaches. Either ignore the manufacturer's instructions and installation CDs and everything, and configure it from first principles based on your knowledge of what you should be doing. Or alternatively, don't do that and take the absolute other approach, which is to follow the instructions given by the manufacturer absolutely to the letter. If you take the second approach and you have difficulties, then what I recommend you do is use the support provided with the product and actually contact the manufacturer and try and troubleshoot what might be going wrong. The plus side of all of this is that when you finally get back to your Mac at home and you realise that networking, file sharing, printing, all of those things on a Mac are generally much more easier than they are for Windows, you can breathe a sigh of relief that you chose a more robust computing platform. That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Has anybody noticed that Tim and Chad have stopped having contests on the original End of the Week MyMac.com podcast? Well, here on the mini podcast, we're going to start having our own mini contests. So get your pens, papers, pencils, and pods poised. And at the end of this segment of John Nemo's All Over the Mac on MyMac.com mini podcast number 14, we will have our first mini contest. But first, we're going to review three items: two computer cases and one iPod case, each one quite unusual in its own way. We're going to start with a brand new product from ifrogs.com, and we will have show notes and links to all the websites for each of the products under consideration. iFrogs is a new company, and my colleague Donnie Yankolo will be reviewing a whole bunch of their iPod Nano cases. But what I have is something called the water-resistant large bags. It costs $10, and the amazing thing about this bag, it's basically just a plastic bag with lots of seals and a cord, and it's just a very, very durable plastic bag that you put your iPod in. And the neat thing is, there's a cable inside that you attach to the audio output of the iPod, and then you can put your headphones or speakers or whatever you have to listen on the outside, so it's protected from the rain or whatever you happen to be doing to get yourself wet. So it's a totally water-resistant case. Now, it doesn't rain very much here in southern Arizona, and I'm not going to take it in the pool with me today. So I'm going to give it a provisional rating of 4 out of 5. It's certainly well-built and a good price for $10. And I'll have updates on this as soon as it rains. I'll take it out and I'll let you know how durable it is, or if I go somewhere where it's drizzling, I'll let you know. Whoops, don't take it scuba diving. There's a disclaimer in two-point type on their website. It says, note, bags for iPod cases are water resistant, as opposed to waterproof, and are not intended to withstand high underwater pressure. Okay, so let's keep it out of the water, but it can get water on it. Next is a product we had a sneak peek of over the summer, and I mentioned it on one of the mini podcasts this summer. It's the OtterBox, and its official name is the OtterBox Rugged Laptop Case, Medium Case, Model Number 7030, for fitting up to 15-inch widescreen computers. It cost $170. Ooh, baby, that's the other end of the pricing spectrum. But this thing is waterproof, it's jump-proof, it's smash-proof, it's guaranteed forever. It will protect your laptop and anything that's inside it from just about anything and everything. And this thing I could take into the swimming pool, but I'm not going to do that until I talk to the company on Tuesday to make sure that my laptop is not going to get ruined by being used as a kickboard, if you know what I mean. So I'm tempted to give this a 4.5 out of 5. My only tiny criticism is that the feet on the bottom, well, they're not really feet, the stoppers on the bottom that keep the case standing upright are not quite as stable as I would like. It could actually keel over a little bit. In other words, its upright support is not quite as upright, permanent, as I would like to see. So let's give this a 4 out of 5, and again, I'll have more information on this. The one thing is, you can't put much more in it. than the computer itself. But when the computer is in there, it's very snug and it's incredibly secure. That's the OtterBox case for the 15-inch laptop, model number 7030. Third thing we're talking about is the gloves, G-L-O-V-E-Z, and that's from case-mate.net. And what the gloves is or are, it's a sleeve, just a very, very simple sleeve that your computer slides into, and it costs about, you know, $30 and up. Comes in three different colors, and I have the silver one and the black one for my PowerBook, my 15-inch PowerBook G4. And it's what I use. I slide the thing in and out. It has Velcro closures. And let's see. I would rate this as a very, very strong 4 out of 5. The thing is, it's so snug that when you put it in and take it out, there's actually a chance that your hand could slip a little bit and the Velcro closures could be a little bit tighter. There's only 2 Velcro closures. I'd rather see 3, but I'm nitpicking here. It's the sleeve that I use every day for safely enclosing my PowerBook, and I can definitely recommend it. Let's get the exact pricing, just a sec. Okay, for your 13 and 15-inch laptop, it's $25, and for your 17-inch laptop, namely the, you know, the PowerBook or the MacBook Pro, it's $30. Good value. You know, it's lightweight, it's durable, excellent construction, and a lot of thought has gone into this sort of spongy, slightly corrugated material that they use that you can read about on the website. Oh, free UPS ground shipping. Terrific. I like that. Well, it's time for our contest here on the MyMac.com mini podcast. And what we have also from case-mate.net is the Signature Series of their form-fit leather cases for iPod Video 6080, which is the same case, or 30. And we are going to give these cases away. I have, let's see, one of, well, hang on a second. Let me check my inventory here. We will be giving away to 5 lucky winners the form-fit leather case from case-mate.net. And I've got 2 60 or 80 in blue and 2 60 or 80 in tan, and then 1 30 gig iPod case in brown. So how do you win these? Since this is our first contest, let's see if we can get this right. Well, the email address that you use is my previous one for the No Snooze review. So that's going to be nosnooze@gmail.com. Let's spell this. NOSNOOZE, nosnooze@gmail, that's gmail.com. And you've got till, well, let's see, how about Friday night? You've got till this Friday night. What's that date going to be? November the 10th at midnight Eastern Standard Time. You send 1 email per person, please. Don't bury me with this. It's just me. And so send 1 email per person to nosnooze@gmail.com. And in your subject header, you're going to put mini podcast contest. Mini podcast contest. And then in the actual content of your message, give me your name, your mailing address, your telephone, your email, the best time to reach you, if I'm going to call you. And if you have the 60 gig or 80 gig iPod, let me know if you'd prefer the blue or the tan. If you have any questions, just send them to me if you want, nosnooze@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening to the MyMac.com mini podcast. Oh, one thing, I'm sorry if you're out of the continental United States, I can't honor your contest entry because I'm just going to have to put it in an envelope and I'm paying for the shipping myself. And these were donated to MyMac.com by case-mate.net. So I'm sorry, this is only for people in the regular postal United States. But please enter our contest. Thanks for listening to the mini podcast. And I want to give my personal congratulations to David Cohen for his excellent fenestration. I have no interest whatsoever in what his content is, because I hope I never touch a Windows computer on my Windows software on my Macintosh. But I think his content is great. Robert's reviews are really, really right on target. And Mr. Not Mac News, Searle, Guy, you're doing a terrific job, and thank you for joining Tim and Chad on the original podcast. Congratulations to all of my colleagues. Thanks for listening. See you next week, and we'll have a contest winner or two or three or four or five, and I hope I get some more stuff so we can give away more stuff. Talk to you soon, everybody. This is All Over the Mac, John Nemo, signing off.
Hi everyone, Robert Hazelreed with another Speed E review. This week I want to talk to you about Adobe Stock Photos and about a horrible experience I recently had with Adobe customer service. I'm an Adobe fan. I live and breathe an Adobe Creative Suite. It's how I make my money. By day, when I'm not podcasting, I am an art director. And I have been using Adobe software packages since their inception. I was an original beta tester for Photoshop 1, and I've been using Illustrator since Illustrator 88, so almost 20 years now. Wow, that's a long time. Anyway, if you are a CS2 user, such as I, you will notice that you have an application now at your disposal called Adobe Bridge. And Bridge is a file management utility and image browser. It also works with version queue. It has a lot of different components to it, but for the most part, I don't find myself using it all that often. Recently, Adobe Stock Photos, we ran a promotion where if you spent X amount of dollars, you got a free pair of Bose headphones. I figured it was enough of an incentive for me to give it a try, but when I did, I ran into a big, big, big headache. When I was in Adobe Bridge, I clicked on the tab that says Adobe Stock Photos. I did a search, and I actually found an image that was useful to me and went ahead and tried to make a purchase. Now, the way this works is very similar to any other online shopping cart. You click the thing that you want to buy, you add it to your shopping cart, and then you go to a checkout. The difference here is once you've gone through the checkout, it adds your image to a download queue. From the download queue, you can download your image. Well, what had happened to me was the first time through, the image didn't go into my download queue. So I thought something had gone wrong with my purchase. At that time, I went back through all the steps and made the purchase again. The second time through, everything seemed to work fine. But I realized that I might have two rather large charges on my credit card now. So I called Adobe immediately and told them of my dilemma. Customer support said, "No problem, Robert. All you have to do is fill out this form, and that my credit card would be refunded in two billing cycles." Okay, I'll fill out the form. It's not the worst thing that could happen to anyone. You know, I know it would be easier if had I been shopping at a grocery store and been charged twice for an item. I could just go back and say, hey, somebody made a mistake here. Could you just correct this for me? I inadvertently purchased the same item twice, but I only want one. The customer tech support gentleman that I spoke to directed me to a specific application to fill out. And I went ahead and did this, and at the time I had asked him, "Are you sure this is the correct form? This says letter of destruction for software, and this is not software, this is an image." Well, he assured me that it was the correct form. I went ahead and filled it out and faxed it in the next day. A few weeks later, I had noticed that there had been nothing done on my charge and just thought I would call and check on it to see how things were progressing. At that time, I spoke to a different individual who said, "You didn't fill out the right form. I want you to fill out this form." And I said, you're kidding, because I did question this to begin with. At this time, I wasn't all that frustrated. I mean, you know, people make mistakes, right? I made one in buying the image twice. So this tech had directed me to a new form, another letter of destruction. I filled that one out, faxed it in, and then later, that same day, I got an email back from Adobe saying, oh no, this is the wrong form. You need to fill out this one. This time, they emailed me the form to fill out. I was just starting to lose my patience at this point, but filled out the form and quickly emailed it back. Then the following day, I got another email that said, oh no, this is the wrong form. You need to do this one. Now, if you're keeping count, that's right. So far, I have filled out 4 forms. At this point, my patience was lost, and I called to talk to a tech, and I said to them, are you certain that this is the correct form? They assured me that it was, and that if I filled it out, it would go to a review process, and after the review process, my money would be refunded. So, what do you think happened at this point? I'll give you a second to guess. Well, it wasn't an issue with the form this time. Apparently, I did fill out the correct form. And they did issue a refund. But guess how much for? $1. Oh, did I tell you that the original image cost $444.99? Now I'm thinking to myself, there must be some mistake here. And called them again. This time when I called, I spoke to a different tech support person, explained the whole situation. She was very apologetic and had said that she would look into the matter right away. I was left on hold for about an hour. When she returned to the phone, she said, yes, this issue has been resolved and you have been issued a refund. And I explained to her again that the item that I was returning was $444.99, not a single dollar, which is what I was refunded. So therefore, the matter has not been resolved. I had the matter escalated, got to another manager, who transferred me to tech support, who then transferred me to someone else. Now, I know my story here is going on for 6.5 minutes, but this whole ordeal has gone on for more than 6 weeks, and guess what? They still haven't resolved anything. Today I was promised to get a phone call back from them, from an official who was going to tell me that everything had been processed and everything was okay. Guess what? I never got a phone call. So I made a phone call myself, but this time to my credit card company, where I asked them for a form. And hopefully, with any luck, that form will help me get my money refunded. So, there you have it. 13 emails, 12 telephone calls, 5 forms, and no resolve. Thanks, Adobe customer support. How would I rate Bridge? It's a tool that I don't use that much. How would I rate Adobe Stock Photos? I can get those pictures anywhere. There's nothing unique about the image collections that they have. They exist in Corbis and Getty One and all those other image sites that are all over the internet. Oh, and most of those imagers are cheaper at the other sites as well. So needless to say, I don't recommend Adobe Stock Photos, and I hope if you ever have to call Adobe Tech Support that you don't have to go through the amount of frustration that I am still going through to this date. I apologize for this long segment. It's not the speediest Speed E review I've ever done, but I think it was very important to go through all the details of my frustration and disappointment. As always, thanks for listening. This has been Robert Hazelrig.
Hey, Tim Robertson, the publisher and owner of MyMac.com. For those who listened to the original podcast last week, MyMac Podcast number 106, Guy Searle and I did an interview with Dwayne McDuffie. Unfortunately, something was going on with my email. I wasn't getting all my email on a timely basis, and one of the emails I did not receive, unfortunately, was an audio commentary sent in by David Cohen on the Greenpeace at the Mac Expo. So I want to play that now, and let's take a listen.
Hello, Tim and Guy. This is David Cohen, your MyMac.com London Bureau Chief, checking in to give you a bit more information about the London Mac Expo Greenpeace controversy. As I mentioned in my written report, when I arrived at the show and saw that Greenpeace were there, I did take the time to go over and have a word with them. Firstly, let me say that their booth was very small, but their branding was slightly odd, in that Greenpeace wasn't really particularly being heavily promoted. In fact, the principal promotion was their actual campaign logo, which is Green My Apple. There was a few pictures of young Asian children standing in front of piles of computer junk, holding up keyboards with Apple logos and that sort of thing on as well. Now, I took the time to get the full sales pitch from them, and basically the argument they were putting forward was that they believe that Apple is one of the more progressive companies in the industry, and yet has one of the worst records in terms of their recycling targets, and the way their equipment ends up in Far Eastern landfills and being recycled in Far Eastern sites where they don't care very much for environmental regulations. Now, they said they were targeting Apple because they felt that Apple, being a progressive and innovative company, would be more likely than other people in the industry to actually take notice of their campaign and do something about it. However, within the same breath, the Greenpeace chap that I spoke to also said, but of course as well, you know, Apple's very public eye, and if we target Apple, then we're going to get some publicity. So whether he meant to say that on the record or not, he actually said it, and I heard him saying that to somebody else as well. Now, I actually did have a couple of problems with their overall approach on this. Firstly, we do have environmental regulations regarding the recycling of computer waste within the European Union, and I did mention this to him, but he seemed to be not overly concerned about that, basically because he says, oh, well, it's all very well, they're going to recycle anyway, but the way they recycle means that they end up in the Far East and all the plastic gets burnt off to get at the copper and this, that and the other. So even though they are recycling, it's not environmental enough. Well, okay, but that's surely they should be targeting the recycling companies if that's the problem, not necessarily computer manufacturers. Secondly, of course they are targeting Apple. Now, Apple's got this mythical 5% market share. I don't know how true that number is, but that is the number that gets bandied about whenever people talk about Apple's market share. Well, 5% of the market is not particularly large, and as Guy mentioned on the podcast last week, and this is something that I agree with, Apple equipment doesn't actually tend to get binned as quickly as a Dell or an HP or another computer. All those Windows machines, they get old very quickly and they do tend to get thrown out and replaced. Certainly in my company, that's what I've seen. And yet Apple equipment tends to go on and on and on, partly due to the design, partly due to the build quality, and partly due to the software and the backwards compatibility that Apple builds into their systems. For instance, I have here, within sort of 500 yards of where I'm sitting now, I probably have 3 or 4 old Mac PowerBooks, 6 to 8 years old, the majority of them. One of them's definitely running the latest version Tiger of the operating system, and the older ones are running 10.2 Jaguar, and all running very nicely and doing a good job. So those are 8-year-old, 6-year-old computers that aren't going to be binned. They're going to be keep on and have a useful life. And I think that's something that Greenpeace haven't really considered in their campaign. Okay, so that's the morals of the issue they're actually bringing up, discussed, and a view can be taken on that. Let's talk a little bit about what they actually got up to at the show. Now, when I spoke to this chap and I was having a discussion with him, I happened to notice that stood at the end of this very small booth, it was only about 4 or 5 feet wide, but stood to one side, there was a photographer. He was wearing a badge, and the badge said his name, and it said Greenpeace on it. So there can be no doubt that he was with the Greenpeace organisation for the purpose of taking photographs. Now, they were handing out flyers encouraging people to write to Apple to raise this issue directly with them. They also had a pile of T-shirts that were slightly disingenuous. They were the familiar black Apple-style T-shirts with coloured dancing people on the front, and on the back a logo that said, Green My Apple. Underneath it said, I love my Apple, I just wish it was green. And they were also handing out organic apples. There was a couple of pretty girls in baskets who were wandering around handing out these apples. I'd noted these people when I arrived at the show. They were actually congregated near the front door, again dressed in these t-shirts and handing out these apples. Now, the problem with that is that at first glance, you would assume they were something to do with Apple Computer. They're handing out apples, they're wearing Apple-style t-shirts. It's only when you look a bit closer you realise that they're not, they're actually Greenpeace. And obviously, once you start speaking to them, it very quickly becomes clear that they're Greenpeace. Now, I stayed for the whole afternoon at the show, and obviously towards the end of the afternoon, you do tend to see people wandering around handing out free stuff. I was approached by a couple of guys handing out Google t-shirts. There was a couple of people who would leave their stands later on the afternoon and start wandering around trying to drum up business, that sort of thing. And there was also a few competitions going on where if people had badges or pins or were wearing t-shirts for a particular company, then they would have spotters out on the floor and they might get approached to win a prize, that sort of thing. So there were people milling around, sort of away from their booths, towards the end of the afternoon, shortly before the show closed. Now, apparently what happened was that towards the end of the show, on the first day, on the Thursday, they were approached by the organisers who were told that they had breached terms of their booth agreement, and consequently they wouldn't be allowed to represent their situation the following day, and effectively they would be denied access to their booth from that day onwards. The reasons for this were several complaints had been received by the organisers. Some of those complaints had come from people on the show floor who said they'd been accosted by these people from Greenpeace, and they hadn't really liked being approached in the manner they were approached. There were also some complaints from some of the other vendors at the show, saying that the Greenpeace people had been standing in front of their stands, taking pictures, and also handing out information to people who were visiting their stands. Now, the organisers say that this was beyond the terms of Greenpeace's agreement. And secondly, the organisers have also said that when Greenpeace took the stand, they did not make it clear that it was a Greenpeace stand. They basically only talked about the Green My Apple campaign, and they made out that they were an organisation called Green My Apple. It's worth also pointing out at this stage that this show is not organised by Apple Computer. They do appear at the show, they do have generally the biggest stand at the show, but it is organised by an independent company, and it is not organised on behalf of Apple Computer specifically. My understanding from the fact that Macworld UK issues a show guide that's a special issue, effectively, that integrates the show into the magazine, that the publishers of Macworld UK are in fact one of the prime sponsors behind the show. I think we need to keep that comment uppermost in our minds when we talk about this, because I've seen a lot of web reporting saying that Apple evicted Greenpeace from the show, and that is clearly not true. So the long and the short of it is that Greenpeace apparently breached the terms of their license to appear at the show, and subsequent to that it became apparent that Greenpeace themselves hadn't represented themselves to the organisers in terms of what they wanted to do at the show, and on that basis the organisers denied them continuation at the show for the rest of the run. Now, I'm sure arguments may continue about what exactly they did or didn't do and whether that specifically breached the terms of their agreements or not. But I've certainly seen on the web, since this happened, pictures of one of these two girls who was handing out the organic apples from the baskets on the actual Apple stand. Now, that photograph was taken by a Greenpeace photographer on the Apple stand, and that was somebody who was handing out information and product related to a Greenpeace campaign, and they were doing it on the Apple stand. So as far as I'm concerned, the organisers are right to say that Greenpeace people breached the terms of their agreement, and consequently, they were within their rights to deny them entry to the show for the rest of the time there. Now, bearing in mind that there were these activities on the Apple stand, there is no doubt in my mind as well that the Greenpeace people probably did approach people who were working or were representing Apple Computer, and that information was then fed back to the organisers. Now, I don't think that would have helped Greenpeace's cause, even though I wouldn't accept the suggestion that Apple have the power or are in the position to actually deny people access to the show, because, as I say, again, Apple are not the principal organisers of the show. Now, there have also been suggestions that, in fact, Greenpeace did all of this deliberately in the interest of creating publicity. Now, I'm not sure about that. I believe they deliberately went to the show and represented themselves in an Apple-like manner because they knew that would garner them publicity. And as I said, one of their staff actually admitted to me that targeting Apple was a deliberate ploy to gain publicity. Whether they deliberately got themselves kicked out or were deliberately annoying in order to raise more publicity about their cause, I'm not so sure. What I do know is whether they did it on purpose or not, I don't believe that this sort of thing actually reinforces their cause at all. It makes them come across like slightly off-the-wall wackos who are prepared to do anything in the interest of promoting their particular cause. And I don't believe that promotes rational debate about the arguments they're making. It tends to debase their argument and makes you think, well, if they're going to do wacky things, if they're going to ignore rules, if they don't think that the rules apply to them, then their arguments probably don't stack up either. I'm sure there is a problem with recycling of computer equipment in the third world. You know, everybody understands that over here in the West, we sometimes end up doing things deliberately or inadvertently that have a negative impact on the environment and economics of the third world. So that's a problem that does need to be tackled. But really, I don't think that Greenpeace, with their Green My Apple campaign, are going about it the right way. Now, Greenpeace's response to this has been to try and play down any wrongdoing on their part and try and imply that this was discomfort from Apple about their campaign that caused this situation to occur. Again, I don't really agree with that, and I don't think they're doing themselves or their campaign any favours. Well, that's my thoughts on the issue and my understanding of what exactly went on. I'd be interested to hear your comments, and I look forward to hearing them on the podcast.
Thanks, David. I appreciate the report from the Mac Expo there and what happened with Greenpeace and why they got kicked out. Obviously, I wasn't there, and instead I'm going to recount a similar experience that I personally had with Greenpeace. At the time, I was an IT manager, information technologies manager for a company, and the sole company that we worked with at the time was Kellogg's. My office actually was in the Kellogg corporate headquarters. I remember going outside for lunch one day, and I see this very strange-looking Tony the Tiger that was actually made up to look like Frankenstein. And they were just kind of lounging around, these guys, out in front of Kellogg's, not actually on the property, but across the street. And there was maybe three or four of them. They had a few signs, but they weren't waving them around. They were just kind of standing there. So I went up to them, and I said, what are you guys doing? And they said, well, we're with Greenpeace, and we're demonstrating here at Kellogg's today. I said, well, what are you demonstrating against? And they said, they had these big signs that I could see, and they said Frankenfood and that sort of thing, and the beef that they had with Kellogg's was that some of the suppliers of the corn and that sort of thing that Kellogg used genetic engineering to get a higher yield of crop, which is always a good thing. If we're going to feed the world, we need to take advantage of the science out there to make our food supply better, healthier, and easier to grow, that sort of thing. Well, Greenpeace doesn't like that. They think it's against nature or something, I don't know. But they were out there to protest, and I thought that was pretty cool. And they were very low-key about it. They weren't even handing out flyers or anything. And the retarded-looking Frankenstein Tony Tiger was just kind of standing around. It wasn't too long before the media showed up, and by media I meant one reporter and one camera. That's when the Greenpeace people sprang into action, yelling, screaming, marching in front of Kellogg's, making a big spectacle of themselves. Every one of them was mugging for the camera, looking angry, saying that Kellogg's is using Frankenfood and, you know, that sort of thing. And the reporter got her sound bite, and the camera stopped rolling, and the Greenpeace people left. So all they were really there for was to get on camera. And to me, that was very disingenuous. it told me they don't really care about these issues. They care about getting people fired up and increasing their funding and making money. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of these types of organizations start out with the best of intentions, and they end up as sort of a quasi-bureaucracy themselves, and they lose credibility. The only thing that they really care about at the point that Greenpeace that I saw was making money and getting on the news. They didn't really care about the issues. One of the guys I actually talked to, I asked him, I said, do you eat, you know, Kellogg cereal? And he said, yeah. I said, well, then why are you protesting it? He said, well, it's because I want them to use natural foods, not genetically engineered or modified foods. And I said, well, what's wrong with the genetically engineered foods? Why is that such a bad thing? And he really couldn't give me a good answer. He kind of hee-hawed around it, and well, it's always better to use natural. Well, why? Well, he kind of hee-hawed around that. So I think their efforts were disingenuous. Well, I don't want to say their efforts, but the real reason that they were there was disingenuous. It was simply to recruit new people by getting on the news, and by getting on the news, hoping that, you know, they're going to make some more money. So, as far as Greenpeace at the Mac Expo, I say good for the event organizers, you know. If Greenpeace had played by the rules and were decent and were really there to get the message out in a understanding and what's the word I'm looking for? If they would have simply played nice, because let's be honest, the audience or the demographic of Apple computer users, many of them would probably be sympathetic to that cause. I think that recycling computer goods is a fantastic idea, and I do wish Apple did more. But I don't know that Apple does any less than anybody else, or that they do any more than anybody else. And so, them being Greenpeace protesting at the Mac Expo, I think is disingenuous, and that it was simply a way to get on the news and to try to get their recruitment up, to try to make more money. Thanks a lot for the reporting, David. We appreciate it. And we're going to wrap it up with Guy Searle's Not Mac News. I know I said I was going to play the final part of the Tim, Chad, and Guy off-topic podcast, part 4. On Mini 14, but we're just running real long on time, so I'm going to save it for the next mini podcast. So we're going to finish up with Guy Searle. I want to thank smalldog.com for sponsoring the podcast, and innotech.com, INNO-TECH, for sponsorship as well. Want to remind everybody that this Wednesday, November 8th, at 6 p.m., Chad Perry, my podcast partner on the original podcast, will be at the Grand Rapids Apple Store from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So, the Woodland Mall, Grand Rapids, this Wednesday, 6 to 7, we're going to be doing a workshop on podcasting. We'll show you how we record the podcast, the equipment we use, the programs we use, our editing techniques. And it should be a good time. We're going to do these probably not every month, but we're going to be going up to the Apple Store quite often. We've got a great working relationship with the fine folks up there. And we really hope, you know, maybe one or two of you guys can show up. We will see you then. I'm not sure when the next podcast is going to come out, whether we're going to record a podcast up there or we're going to do another one on Thursday. But there will be a podcast out this week, 107, one way or another. Thanks for listening, and take it away, Guy.
Good evening. This is Not Mac News, I'm your host, Guy Searle, bringing you unverifiable information with a smile. Send your thoughts, comments, threats, lawsuits to notmacnews@gmail.com. Dateline, Cupertino, California. Apple's latest input device offering, the Bluetooth Mighty Mouse, is only the first in line for the company's new wireless products. Apple is said to be working on new input strategies that are not only wireless, but don't require a physical product at all. Information will be entered via mental telepathy and will require surgery to place a large input-output probe in the base of the skull of all potential users. The user will interface with their Macintosh computer just by thinking about their next command, which program they want to open, and what internet sites they wish to go to. Repeated commands will be stored in a database held within the computer and reviewed by a special team at Apple for further development of this new product. Not Mac News asked about privacy issues and was assured by Apple that the default of sending all this information to the company can easily be changed by going to the preference file for the interface, clicking the opt-out box, and then punching themselves in the nose. There has been some technical problems with the new interface. Apparently, after one of the testers went to a website that featured pornography, he declared his undying love for Jenna Jameson and then proceeded to pester everyone until they agreed to purchase herbal Viagra. Two other issues with the interface have been that system freezes could possibly stop your heart, and that updating the drivers for the skull-based probe via software update had a tendency to wipe out the user's childhood memories. Apple had no comment on the rumor posted at SeekThinkRit.com that a kernel panic would cause the user's head to explode. Not Mac News, the best way to start your day outside of electroshock therapy. I'm Guy Searle, and I wish you a good day.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.